You're listening to highlights from One Planet Podcast's interview with Charlie Herzog-Young, climate change activist and author Spinning Out. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
I've been a climate activist since I was about 12 years old, in different versions, obviously, because there's only so much you can do at 12. But I always had a very deep connection to nature and this deep inbuilt sense that something in the way we lived was out of balance with the way that the earth wanted us to. So it began with a deep passion for wildlife. As I learned more and more about the climate crisis and how sprawling, interconnected it was, not just with nature, but with human flourishing and with so much of the oppression that exists within human society, I started doing more and more involved and impassioned actions. So I started getting involved in protests, marches. It started to become my everything, both in a really exhilarating way where I felt like I was involved in doing something meaningful about the crisis, but also a sense of deep despair and loss, both from the perspective of the impending collapse of the biosphere as I saw it, and also a deep dislocation from the dominant culture and the consensus reality, you know, feeling that nobody else really got it. I started to get incredibly anxious, and that built and played out in lots of deeply confusing ways over a period of years until in 2019, when I was 27, I jumped off a six-story building. And I can't tell you a great deal about that day because I've blacked it out. My memory has blacked it out just from sheer brute trauma. But I then spent a month in a coma and woke up having lost both of my legs. And the time since then, the 5 years since, has mostly been one of not just physical and mental recovery, but also trying to untangle the messy web of causality as to how and why it was that I lost my mind in the way I did. I mean, there's that old saying, blessed are the cracked, for they let in the light. And for a lot of people like myself, I think it's really true that losing your mind can be a proportionate response to the climate crisis. And those of us with mental health issues are often branded as being in our own world. We may seem distant or unaware or unattached to our surroundings. We might instead have a vacant or overzealous otherworldliness. Either way, it appears to leave us unreachable. And paradoxically, being in our own world can actually be a result of being more connected to the outside world rather than less. People who fail to develop psychological symptoms as being in their own separate anthropocentric world, inattentive to the experiences, as you say, of the billions of other human and non-human beings on the planet, unaffected by looming existential catastrophe. There are layers and layers of insulation made up of civilizational narratives that dislocate many people from climate chaos. And there are lots of studies that show, not that in my opinion we need studies to prove these things, because many cultures have known them for a long time, but there are lots of studies that show that certain forms of psychosis are actually a form of meaning making for communities that are lost. And by lost, I mean feel like they have no sense of purpose. We've had generations and generations of trauma visited upon the human species by picking apart communities, our intimate relationships with nature, and more recently, you know, especially since the 80s, picking apart our inability to even consider ourselves as part of society in a meaningful sense. And that kind of pulling apart means that we're locked in quite individual and atomized spaces where, when something as massive as climate change starts to happen, people feel both responsible for it and completely unable to do anything about it. And so I think certain kinds of madness, like psychosis, are entirely appropriate to try and, like a dream, find symbols and signals and compass points for us to find our way collectively out of it again. I used to be in a space where as soon as I felt kind of devastatingly ill, I had to hurl myself back at the problem of climate change or something to do with new economics or something to do with a new kind of politics. And I would end up very quickly burning out, you know, hitting myself up against despair. While I do think that it's deeply, deeply important for us to engage with these issues, it's really important that we engage with them in a way that isn't trying to approach them with an internal sense of emergency. And that said, there is a very well understood multi-generational knowledge that it is only by addressing these issues ourselves that we can start to resolve some of the trauma that they've caused in our own being. So one of the biggest issues I've found talking to people about this, and it was a huge surprise to me, was that almost everyone that I raised this with has some version of what people often call eco-anxiety or climate anxiety. And even though it's very much in popular culture, it's not something that people will discuss with people they're close to. They don't like to bring it up because they feel like they're going to kill the mood. But I think one of the other things is that people still have this sense that if it's a mental health issue that's caused by their feelings about climate change, it doesn't count as an actual problem. Do you know what I mean? And that's very much an issue in the global north, having this sense that a problem that's as distant as climate change, potentially geographically, but also in terms of the future, you know, being like pre-traumatic stress almost for what might happen to us, doesn't seem like something worth taking seriously, either for the person feeling it or for the people that they want to talk to about it. And I think that only by opening up and discussing it tenderly with one another can we start to build a deeper sense of connection and also solidarity and potentially collective action through the realization that everybody's got a version of it. And when I was trying to get the book written initially, it was quite hard to have sections on the Global South because people would consider, if there's a massive drought and people have to move, of course there's going to be suffering. And so it's seen as natural suffering or inevitable suffering. And in my eyes, and in the eyes of many of the people I spoke to about this, it's an extension of the kind of othering that is already visited upon the Global South, because it says that people's mental health issues, people's psychological distress don't count as depression, as PTSD, as anxiety, because, you know, obviously people will be sad or upset or having a hard time if they've experienced a natural disaster. And that maps onto what's often the inevitable response from organizations like the WHO, which is to fly in and to deliver antidepressants or, you know, some form of medication and then helicopter out again. And local doctors that are there working on the ground with people say that that's not just a sticking plaster solution, it's no solution at all. Because if people's entire network of support has evaporated, you've got to be working with communities. We could respond to a massive mental health crisis arising from climate impacts by just investing loads of money in training new psychiatrists and dotting them about a community with, let's be honest, quite a rigid, old school biomedical understanding of what mental health issues are. Or we could build an ecosystem of care, right? Where people who are the community members are trained and can start to learn, not just learn mental health first aid from biomedical literature, which is useful, but also teach psychiatrists, psychologists, and teach social workers and community care workers. Well, I'd actually never heard the term 5 years ago, but post-traumatic growth is this belief that some practitioners have that after a traumatic event, it's possible for people to not just recover and come back to the position they were in before the trauma, but actually grow through it and find a much more meaningful way of existing. I managed to, talking to lots of practitioners, talking to lots of people who've been through similar things, find a few facets of what can prime us for post-traumatic growth. And one of them is cognitive flexibility. So the willingness and the ability and the capacity to accept new versions of ourselves and new understandings of the world, which is a very difficult thing to do when you're in this hypervigilant state of post-traumatic stress. So feeling safe is deeply important. And one of the most important things for that is having safe relationships and feeling like we can trust other people and that other people trust us. So I think that a lot of us have a bit of a gap in ourselves, a kind of spiritual void that's often caused by not feeling like we're in step with the rest of society because we can see looming catastrophe or that we can see generalized apathy in the context of something that's deeply important to us, you know, whether that's climate change or the biosphere or just generally a lack of meaning in the way that we live at the moment. I've found that having had something pretty extreme and traumatic happen to me has forced me to dig quite deep and find again what it is that I see as important in my life. And for me, this is just my own feeling, but for me, it's trying to be on the side of nature and human flourishing in the face of a civilization and a global economic system that does seem intent on destroying the ecosphere and intent on destroying human flourishing. But one of the ways that I try and maintain a feeling of safety while also not collapsing into a state of passivity, and it's taken a very long time for me to learn this, but is being forgiving with myself. And one of the people who I write about a lot in the book, Jennifer Uchendu, who is a Nigerian climate and mental health activist who set up an organization called the Eco Anxiety in Africa Project, she talks about needing to remind herself constantly. Her test is not whether she's doing enough, it's whether she's doing her best. And doing her best doesn't mean doing as much as she possibly can, it means having the right balance. Self-care and action. So it changes all the time because I find different things helpful at different times. I think that having Labour back in power opens up a lot of opportunities, but I also feel like we cannot be complacent about this. We can't be complacent about the fact that Labour won a massive majority in the House of Commons, but they barely increased their vote share at all. So some people are talking about it as a sandcastle majority because their popular support is actually very low. We also saw the rise of the Green Party, which I think is a really promising thing. They increased their seats from 1 to 4. I think denial is something that I've thought about for years, obviously. But I do think that a lot of the rise of the far right, the rise of the alt-right, that kind of fury is very often, this might seem like an outlandish claim, but it's very often displaced fear about climate change and about the general systemic unraveling of the world. So I've found that the most effective way to speak to people who don't believe that climate change is a thing is to listen, and not to listen in order to find something to contradict them on, but to listen and to try and get to the root of why it is that they feel that way. Well, oh, I mean, we could have spent the whole episode talking about this because I have a lot of half-baked opinions about this stuff. But I think that certain kinds of AI can be really helpful for, as you say, balancing the grid, or by relieving humans of certain kinds of manual, repetitive, or arduous labor, so long as that actually transfers into people having more time. I do think that there are some useful, utilitarian, appropriate uses of it. But they should be really boundaried and kept limited. But I think a lot of the growth of human dominance over the ecosystem and the dominance of a certain kind of human life over many other kinds of human life, I'm worried that AI will serve those interests that have already subjugated and dominated because of the kinds of intelligence it chooses to put central to its way of operating. And that is cutting things up into smaller pieces in order to understand them better, rather than looking at a genuine interacted whole. It takes a bit of courage, actually, to just decide to slow down, sit down, think, admit our mistakes, and experiment with different ways of being, like different structures for societies, different priorities for economies, for instance. I think deeper down, I'm concerned because we call it artificial intelligence, but we don't even know what organic intelligence is. We have a very limited and very brittle understanding of what intelligence is, what the mind. We now see the mind almost like it's a circuit board. And not only does that have really significant negative consequences for people with mental health issues and the othering of large groups of people, it's also just a deeply broken and inaccurate model of the mind. So we know very, very, very little. And some people talk about there being three major aspects of mind. One is individual psychology and your physiology. One is in your social network, your social system. We're hypersocial beings. And the other is how we're connected to the ecosphere, what flows in and out of our bodies and in and out of our minds. And that's a two-way relationship in all of those cases. And so if we as a society are building what we're calling artificial intelligence, when we've got a deeply flawed and frankly quite infantile understanding of what intelligence is, then we're going to build something that is not in any way linked in healthily with the ecosystem that we exist in and depend on. let alone human society. I'd say AI is undeniably incredibly clever, but it's very clever in a very particular kind of quantitative left brain way. And there are many other ways of being that the people who are designing artificial intelligence software tend not to prioritize or even see or think. And there are all kinds of tacit knowledges in human cultures all around the globe that couldn't even make their way into something that relies on that kind of infrastructure. The thing that was important to me was having mentors. And I would really recommend that young people take a bit of a risk and ask people that they want to learn from, whether they can spend time with them and do things with them and listen to their stories and learn from their experiences. I think one of the most promising things is rebuilding intergenerational relationships. And this fight is one that has been going on for generations upon generations. It is a fight that is as old as human civilization. And so I think when you ask, what is it you'd like young people to know and preserve? I think one of the main things I'd like them to know is that they don't have to reinvent the wheel. So to reach out to those that they want to emulate and be like, and trust those relationships. This is just the beginning of part three, which is about taking collective action. There is a spectacular and fortuitous set of feedback loops that turn engaged action into a powerful therapeutic method. This is not a utilitarian transaction where helping others or doing good just makes us feel better. It is a reciprocal arrangement, like the management of a commons. And it is about finding purpose and meaning by joining communities of care. It is also about creativity, the opportunity to align our talents with our ethics, and creating enclaves in which we can more fully explore who it is we want to be. Together, we try to build the relationships we have always wanted out of new practices and priorities. This leads to meaningful, impactful action. It is fertile territory for the birth of new worlds.
We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening.